Ink and Paint wishes to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the traditional owners of the land on which this podcast is recorded and edited. It is a great privilege to be able to tell stories on this land, which has a tradition of storytelling stretching back over 10,000 years. We also wish to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands from all over the world where our guests record from. We pay our respects to all elders past, present, and emerging, and to our First Nations listeners.
I'd like to show your listeners something that few people ever see. I'd like to take them through the various rooms of the artists and the animators and try to show just how pictures like Cinderella and Alice in Wonderland come to life on the screen.
Well, that would be wonderful.
You step right through this door.
Oh, yes. And while we pause on the threshold of this wonderful treat, let's hear a word from the announcer.
Hello, and welcome to the very first Ink and Paint In-Betweener, a series of bonus episodes expanding on the story of the Disney animated classics. I'm your host, Daniel Lamon. For each of the main episodes of Ink and Paint, I do a lot of research into the making of the films and the history of Disney animation, but a lot of really great stories have to be left out, either because they don't relate directly to a particular film, or to stop the episodes from being 5 hours long. With these bonus in-betweeners, I'll be sharing some of those stories. Sometimes there'll be interviews with more exciting guests, sometimes there'll be mini audio documentaries, and sometimes other exciting tidbits I found along the way. We'll be releasing them sporadically throughout the main series, often when they'll best complement one of the main episodes, so make sure you've subscribed so as not to miss any of them. For our very first in-betweener, we're going to take a moment to look at the actual process of animation itself. It's one thing to watch these films with the understanding that everything we're seeing was made by hand. It's quite another to fully comprehend exactly how much work has gone into them and exactly how they were made, particularly these early films. In fact, both the names Ink and Paint and In-Betweener reference actual steps in the animation process. During the making of Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, Walt Disney realized that the studio at Hyperion Avenue was grossly understaffed to pull off the ambitious project. Walt turned to art instructor Don Graham, a Canadian-American fine artist who had been the head of internal training at the studio since 1932. He told Graham he needed 300 new artists, right now, and that it was Graham's job to find the right candidates. In a long memo to Graham in 1935, Walt outlined the qualities he believed were essential for a good animator. 1. Good draftsmanship. 2. Knowledge of caricature, of action as well as features. 3. Knowledge and appreciation of acting. 4. Ability to think up gags and put over gags. 5. Knowledge of story construction and audience values. And 6. Knowledge and understanding of all the mechanical and detailed routine involved in his work in order that he may be able to apply his other abilities without becoming tied in a knot by lack of technique along these lines. Now, rather than me rattling off a bunch of facts I've read in a book, I figured it would be much better to ask an actual animator to talk us through the process of creating a piece of animation. So, joining me for our very first in-betweener is Sydney-based artist Todd Fuller. With a practice that integrates sculpture, moving image, performance, and painting, Todd is, at his core, a draftsman. Underpinning all aspects of his practice is a love of drawing and a belief in its power as a democratic medium to connect, engage, and delight audiences. A graduate of Sydney's National Arts School, Todd has exhibited widely across Australia and internationally over the last decade. Todd, welcome to Ink and Paint.
Thanks for having me, Daniel.
So talk to us a little bit about your experience, not just with animation, but as your general arts practice, because your practice covers a wide range of artistic forms.
Yeah, I've been doing hand-drawn films for probably 10 years, and that desire or that quest for the moving image started for me at the National Arts School. I wasn't trained as an animator. I definitely didn't study film. I trained in drawing and sculpture. But the things I found at art school was, or the thing I found at art school was that I'd always had this really vivid imagination. I'd always drawn characters. I'd always drawn comic books and had these really sort of almost vivid soap operas with my toys as a childhood. And I came to being an adult and as an art maker as an adult, I found that what I was able to make didn't match that sense of life and that sense of movement and the sense of storytelling that I had in my head. So I just started exploring animation as a way not to tell a story, but as a way to activate my drawings in a sense. And yeah, so for the last 10 years, I've kind of been working with where I integrate animation with other things. So I've worked with animating dances, that's both through pre-recording or pre-drawing sessions and also live animating. I've also worked with theater productions, and I've worked extensively and heavily in the gallery sector, which for me is where I'm most comfortable as someone who's trained as an artist, I guess.
And what are the areas of interest in terms of the subjects that you're drawn to as an artist, or the themes or ideas that you're drawn to?
That's a really great question. There's a few things I'm really interested in. One is queer narratives. So I've played with things like the story of Captain Moonlight, the notable Australian bushranger who also had a same-sex partner and was hung with a ring around his finger of his same-sex partner. I've played with a lot of ideas around regional stories. So that's travelling to a place, having an experience in that place, and then trying to retell that experience, whether that's historical or firsthand, and my response to a place. And I've also just explored things like the physics of dance and the physics of animation, if that makes sense.
And how did you find yourself, because you said that you hadn't been formally trained in the process of animation, how did you find your footing with it? Where did you start in terms of teaching yourself or exploring the form?
I did a lot of Googling. I did a lot of spending time in the National Art School Library and looking at early techniques. But I also just experimented and found my own way. So I was looking at sort of pre-Disney experimentation with animation and the moving image, and I was making my own zoetropes and zoopraxinoscopes. I've also made sort of, I guess you would call them animated flipbooks, which is like a dance in 78 drawings that just flip around in a mechanical device that simulates an animation. So I was sort of really interested in how to make an image move and how to do that not just through film, but also how can we achieve that through the physical object. I've also inserted some of those pieces. So I've also played with the screen and inserting screens into sculptures so that not only am I creating the story of a character, but I also create the character and his interaction with his own story, that framework or that paradigm becomes physical through a sculptural object.
Now, to ask a reductive question for something that is probably quite a complex answer, where do you start with the technical side of the animation process? Where do you begin, and what are the steps that you have to take to create a work of animation?
So for me, I start by taping a piece of paper to a wall, and my camera is literally sort of a meter and a half in front of that, and I make a mark and I take a photo, and then I just keep going. I keep not only documenting that drawing coming into being, it being created, but then I start rubbing it back and redrawing it in its entirety. And in doing so, that's how I'm able to simulate movement. My way of working is really different to, say, the cell animations we're going to talk about later, because it is a process that traps its process and makes its process really visible. The history of every gesture, the history of every movement is left and tracked on the page. So it's a process about history and remnants, really.
Why do you think you were drawn to that idea? Because, I mean, that's one of the most thrilling things about watching your animation work, is that the history kind of being still written in the image, it feels incredibly alive. Why do you think you were drawn to that principle rather than something that we would understand, like a traditional kind of clean Disney-style animation?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, I'm really compelled or obsessed with the idea that my works aren't just about a story, they're also about the life and death of a drawing. And that single idea has driven me for the last 10 years. Every one of my works, I want to be like a sketchbook brought to life. And that means savoring the mistakes. That means not trying to polish it, making it as sincere and authentic and human as possible. And to achieve that, my work isn't about perfection in any way, shape, or form.
Why does Walt always ask you to do something you don't know how to do? Why can't he just make a picture of things we know how to do? You know, it'd be a lot easier.
So by comparison, what is your understanding of the Disney process? Because you said that you'd studied a little bit when you were looking into animation as a form, that you'd kind of looked into the history, the pre-Disney period, the Disney period. Yeah, where does the Disney process sit?
Well, it is so, especially early days when we're talking sort of golden age, it is about perfection. It is highly labor intensive. It kind of hides its own thinking in a lot of ways, and it's trying to simulate reality. unlike, I mean, there are changes later when you get to sort of the 101 Dalmatians stage, when the Xerox cameras come into it, sometimes you get those working lines from the artists that sneak into it. And like there's a real magic in that, whereas early Snow White, it's so pristine, it's so perfect. That process was so interrogated, there's no way anything could have been allowed into the finished product that wasn't 100% perfect. Walt had such a keen eye on every step of that process. It was beyond polished.
And when you said it was a labor-intensive process, expand on that a bit for us. Because, I mean, it's one thing that, you know, an audience sitting in a cinema or sitting at home watching an animated film, a hand-drawn animated film, is not thinking about just how much work, physical work, went into that. Talk to us about how, what you know of the amount of work that it would have taken to make one of those films.
Yeah, so years went into these films. It is a really long and complicated process. At the inception, it's this developmental process where they're playing with stories and they're playing with sound. There's a gag man, there's a couple of sketches, they're in the room, they're thrashing out the idea. From there, basically, they come up with like a bit of a storyboard, and that has some sort of inspirational sketches that are, we've all seen those pictures of Walt and his crew sitting around in armchairs with a wall covered in drawings, and that's where those first developments are sort of starting to crystallize. They come up with a bit of a storyboard that indicates how things are going to progress. From there, the next step is they develop a script and they also start composing and scoring the soundtrack. It still shocks me that that happens so early on in the process, because for me the sound almost gets laid on over the top. But in this method of creating an animation, the soundtrack is the core, so that later when they do things like animate, they can sync things up so perfectly, sync up the mood and the gesture as well as the story. The next step, once it's got approval and once they've reviewed all of that, it moves to animation. And so animation is the part where the magic starts. But there's magic in every step of this process. Basically, at the animation step, the key artists are working with sort of those phrases that make up the story, and they're drawing them one frame at a time. Sometimes they'll have an assistant who works on the in-between, so the animator will draw sort of those key moments, and then someone else will come in and they'll specialise in the in-betweening. And that's where you're sort of working on a light desk and you're drawing. You've got one piece of paper down, you get your next piece of paper over the top of it, and you're moving it just a millisecond every single time, and you're layering up sort of hundreds of drawings into a ream that eventually will be documented and will eventually simulate movement. But to do that takes an incredible amount of time. At the end of that process, then it also goes through a test camera process. And so basically every single one of those drawings is documented for the first time. And then that's put onto a reel, and the animator gets a chance to kind of review what they've been working on, and the studio gets to review how the film's looking, and that's where they also get to evaluate things and say, no, we need to redraw that, or that's not going to work, or well done drawing that entire really beautiful scene, but actually it doesn't progress the story, so we're going to chop that onto the floor. And that's a really intense process. I mean, we can talk about that from an emotional point of view. If you're an artist and you've spent weeks or months drawing, say, for example, Seven Dwarfs doing a song about drinking soup, which happened, and then at some point in the process it's just cut. That's a pretty traumatic thing, but it happened a lot, especially at the early stage when they were kind of learning this process and learning how to make it work and learning what would and wouldn't work. So huge amounts of work and huge amount of money were lost in that natural editing process that happens throughout this whole process.
Listening to you talk, it's still mind-boggling to me, the idea that, you know, if a film is 24 frames per second, there are 60 frames in a minute, there are 70-something minutes in an animated film like Snow White or Pinocchio. Like, that's a mind-boggling number to me. I can't, like, my brain just kind of, when it gets to, like, 60 seconds in a minute, my brain just collapses at the idea of the amount of work that must take.
Yeah, the numbers around these films are mind-blowing. Like, Bambi and Snow White both would have had 250,000 approximately cells drawn and painted, and that's just one layer of the process. Like, when you take into account background painting, character development, storyboarding, in-betweening, animation, there would be easily over 1 million pieces of artwork created to make that film. And that is why there were hundreds of artists. That is why it took years. Like, this is not an easy or a quick process. Animation is about patience.
And where does Disney animation fit within the wider story of animation, with the wider history? Because obviously they didn't, it's not an art form that the artists at Disney invented. It had existed for decades before Walt Disney started making his Laugh-O-Grams. Where does Disney fit within the wider story? What had been happening in animation before then, and where does it fit?
I mean, before then, it often animation was used as like the intro reels of a movie. I mean, the way we consumed moving image in this time was so different to now. It's kind of hard to think about the fact that you would only maybe see one movie a month, one moving image experience a month, or even less. Really, it was a bit expensive. It was a whole different world. You know, you weren't sitting down with a TV in your living room. The phone hadn't been invented, obviously. There was no YouTube. Like, it was a really rare and special thing. And Disney came along and he made an institution out of it. He made an industry out of it. He approached it with such innovation that he progressed the medium dramatically. We can talk about his developments in terms of, like, he invented the multi-pane camera, which changed how images were documented. He changed how artists actually trained. He implemented the Academy model, which saw his animators going back to, like, this classical education, this atelier education, and advancing as drawers, which is why visually the work he was creating was such a move forward. No one had done realism through animation until Snow White. You look at, say, dancing figures 10 years earlier in the Silly Symphonies, and their limbs are like rubber hoses, their bones are made of jelly. And then Walt sends his artists to school, basically, because Art Babbitt had been, that's a whole other story, Art Babbitt, one of his lead animators, there's so much content here, had been getting together in life drawing to try and advance their work in his own home, and Disney finds out and he calls Art into his office and says, you know, it's a bad look if the press find out that all our artists are gathering to draw naked women in someone's house, but B, this is a really important way to learn and teach, and I want you to do that here, and I want you to do it after hours, and we'll do it in the sound lab. And that's where this really intense education comes into it. And so that refining of classical art education, that fine art angle comes into it, and that revolutionizes the animation as well. There are so many innovations that he makes.
And later on, scores of girls come in. We call them inkers and painters because they ink and paint the drawings.
I see,
and
yes.
They complete the process.
Uh-huh.
They transfer from the pencil drawings of the artist, they transfer it onto these celluloids. Then these celluloids later on are placed under the camera with the background underneath them and photographed by the camera.
Oh.
And, you know, we use as high as 2,000 different colors in making our pictures.
So after the piece has been approved, that's when real production happens, and that's when you move to, like, the inking stage. And the inking stage, now when I look at that, or I look at documentary footage around it, I kind of cringe because they talk about inking as being this special separate space filled with, like, the quote that I want to reference says something like, it was filled with hundreds of pretty girls in a comfortable building. And it kind of was. It was this separate process and not necessarily a valued process. It wasn't an artistic process. It was this demoted tracing that happened en masse as all those drawings were translated onto celluloid, which is basically like an acetate.
I mean, the men in animation were being paid, like, you know, the top animators could be paid like $300+ a week, and the women in inking and painting could be paid between $6 to $12 a week. Like, in terms of just the gap of respect for the artistry that they were doing, yeah, it's pretty shocking actually to think about, considering how much work was being involved.
Crazy. And then, of course, when it does get to the, like, 101 Dalmatian stage where the Xerox camera takes hold, that whole inking department is just lost. Like, hundreds of artists just lose their job overnight as they realize that hand-drawn job they'd been doing could so easily be replaced by a single machine. But anyway, after inking, there's this other fascinating process, which is the color lab. So one side of the acetate is drawn in ink, and then the other side of the acetate, the paint is put on, but the paint can't be stroked on because you can't have it streaky. It needs to be a consistent tone. So the paint is kind of blobbed into the general area that's inked out on the other side. But even, like, it's mind-boggling that the paint had to be so consistent across so many hundreds, if not thousands, of stills, that at the center of the Colour Lab was basically like a laboratory team live mixing and evaluating paint samples. If Snow White's feet at the start of a sequence were slightly a different tone at the end of a sequence, that's going to throw it all out. So it's beyond a precise science that's going on in this lab.
There's a great story. I think I talked about it in the Snow White episode, where the women in Inkham Paint had said to Walt, wouldn't it be great if Snow White had rouge on her cheeks, like that her cheeks were a little bit brighter. And Walt Disney was like, I mean, yeah, it would be great, but there's no way to keep that consistent. Like, it'd have to be the same in every single frame, and there's no way you can do that. And the women were like, actually, we do it to ourselves every single day. We know exactly how to do that. And proved him completely wrong by pulling it off beautifully. And in every frame, the rouge on her cheeks was in exactly the same place. It's one of my favorite Snow White stories. In terms of the advances that Disney Animation offered the art form, what are some of the greatest contributions that Disney Animation has made to the art of animation? But also, what are some of the negative effects of Disney? What are some of the contributions that have had a negative impact on the way that animation is created, the processes, or the way that you think we interpret or receive it?
I guess in one sense, it kind of sets a benchmark that doesn't leave a lot of room for experimentation. A lot of other people exploring animation didn't have a lot of, if you weren't hitting that level, you weren't going to get a lot of traction. And to achieve the level that Disney was achieving took a lot of money that just wasn't in a lot of other places in the industry. Like when you compare it to, say, some of the other Hanna-Barbera works, you look at how Disney deals with, say, dust and an explosion versus how they use dust and explosion to conceal the interesting stuff.
I think thinking about it as being a benchmark is useful, particularly because then it also, the amount of influence that they have on every other form of animation, both like in, you know, English-speaking countries, but non-English-speaking countries, like anime only exists as a response to Disney Animation, really. I mean, both as a way of, in some respects, as a way of emulating it, and in some respects to counteract it. It's one of the things that's really fascinating about Disney Animation is that no matter what direction you go in, the history of animation, full stop, has to somehow return to Disney. Its influence and impact, both positive and negative, both as something that people can revere, but something that people can also rebel against. I mean, I was rewatching Bambi the other day, and watching it again, I was like, I can see the, like, you can see not just obviously later Disney films like The Lion King, but you can see almost the entirety of Don Bluth's 80s output. Like, The Secret of Nim, American Tail, Land Before Time, they're all responding to Bambi, whether it's trying to emulate it or trying to work against it. The same with, you know, Martin Rosen's Watership Down and the British production of Animal Farm, anything made by Miyazaki or Takahata. There's the DNA of Disney, whether they like it or not, is written into everything. Because how technically accomplished those films were, but also because for us, for most of the world, our first relationship with animation is through Disney films. Why do you think they endure? Why do you think they still stand as the benchmark for the form?
I think you've just nailed that answer on the head with it's so ingrained in our DNA. Like, from a personal perspective, Disney is locked into so many of our experiences so young that it also therefore becomes locked into our individual DNAs. It becomes locked into our lives. We compare and contrast so many of our experiences to the Disney modelling that we have growing up. I mean, how many times have I decided whether or not to continue a relationship based on whether that person makes me feel like a Disney film? Like, it's so ingrained in who we are as a society.
What do you think is the state of Disney animation now?
Ooh, that's I know you're making a point not to talk about the live action situation.
Mostly just because it makes me very upset.
Well, I think in that upset is something that so many of us as animators feel. Like, it's pretty rare that these live action remakes that Disney seems to be focusing on quite a lot at the moment, it's pretty rare that they touch on the magic that is only possible through animation. And so the current Disney focus on those is quite upsetting. But then you look at some of the shorter pieces of animation that are coming out recently, and they still make your heart sing, but there's just that little bit of something missing that were there in the Golden Age and the Renaissance that it's just not quite. It's close, but it just doesn't give you goosebumps like a mermaid singing about wanting to be a human does. It just doesn't do that.
What do you think it is that's missing?
Oh.
I had to ask. As soon as you said there's something missing, I was like, I'm going to ask what it is. What do you think it is? What do you think is missing? Do you think it has to do with the transition to computer animation? Do you think it has to do with something around the storytelling? Like, yeah, for you personally, what do you think is the thing that they've lost?
I think, and I'm going to be very controversial here, and I hope I don't upset a generation of animators, but I think what's happening as we move into computer animation is more and more the training is disappearing. And we see computer animators returning to training, but it's not ingrained in their day-to-day existence like it was for the Disney team. Like if you talk about some of the writings of the golden era, those animators were working, you know, 9 to 5 or whatever at the studio, and then they'd have a quick dinner, and then they'd go back to basically the Animation Academy where they were training, where great artists like Don Graham were getting them excited and training their eyes and focusing on not just story, but how to get the most out of every single mark you're putting on a page, how to understand the thing in front of you that is a real thing, how to make that real thing emulated on the page. But not only how do you emulate it, how do you push it, how do you pull it, how do you exaggerate it, how do you turn a clock into a character that makes you feel something, how do you do that? The reason they were able to do that was because they were training artists in a grand tradition and in a refined and an exciting and a compelling way.
And a way that kind of places it within the wider scope of the history of art. Like, that's the thing of, like, you look at the Golden Age films. Actually, to be honest, everything I would argue up until maybe the early 2000s in the Disney output, to some extent, you can place it somewhere as in within the wider context of the conversation of visual art, in that all of them are in some way in conversation with them. Like, it may be in big, grand, sweeping gestures, like in something like Fantasia, or it might be in really minute, subtle ways, just little moments or little touches that mean that it's the really beautiful thing about a great animated film is that you feel like you're watching it be part of the wider millennia long conversation about artistic expression, that it's about the digging into the human and digging into the primal and our ability to visualize our dreams and visualize our thoughts and our hopes by putting a pencil to a piece of paper.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that. And also, there's an exchange that we often don't think about, which is between, we often think about Disney and animation as separate to the historical art narrative of modernism, but actually there's this really interesting exchange between a lot of key practitioners going on. Like, Walt Disney, like, worked with Salvador Dali. Some of the partners of the nine gray men were going over to Europe and they were having lunch with Picasso and Chagall. Like there was a real exchange and understanding and connectivity between the experimentation and the interrogation and the innovation happening in fine art and in animation. And it's really easy historically to forget that this was all happening at the same time and there were some really exciting exchanges going on. And that's not to say that they aren't still going on, but when you look back, there was a real magic going on. They were really on the edge of something really special and they were writing that and they were aware of that. And I think that energy also is what makes these pieces so exciting when we look at them from now.
I'll bet, Donald, you're glad you're just a duck and not an animator.
Well, to finish up with one last question, I'm going to throw the question at you that I ask all the guests on this podcast. What is your favourite Disney film?
It is without a doubt 101 Dalmatians. It's the time, it's the moment where they peel back some of their processes, they get rid of the inking process, and all of a sudden the marks of the animators, the actual marks of the animators, which had been concealed for so long and had laid in the morgue basically, rarely being seen by anyone other than other animators, suddenly a bit so ingrained and visible in the process. You know, I just love, I did it the other night. I watched 101 Dalmatians, but I paused and slowed down as much as I could. And every now and then you get that little flick that's like the mark across the eyes that says, no, that's the middle of the head, or the mark through the body that says, this is the gesture. And that is the first mark that created and enabled that whole character to happen. All of that structure and knowledge and learning of the artist is made bare, and it's a beautiful thing.
And it's such a shock to think about it chronologically, that the film before 101 Dalmatians, which has like the visual language of that film, is so spontaneous and immediate and alive. And to think that the film they made before that is Sleeping Beauty, which may be the most technically perfect piece of animation ever made, like a living painting, and then to a living drawing, that they sit right next to one another, is kind of astounding.
Mm. And I think Walt didn't actually like 101 Dalmatians. I think he was mourning the loss of the art form he'd kind of built. But it went super well in terms of critical reviews. And I mean, also those backgrounds, like how do you not mention those beautiful backgrounds that are so modern and so contemporary? And it's just, I've got goosebumps thinking about it. 101 Dalmatians all the way.
Well, Todd, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and talking to us about this amazing art form and your knowledge and experience with it.
No dramas. Thanks for having me, Daniel.
Thanks again to Todd Fuller for sharing his knowledge on the animation process with us on our very first Ink and Paint In-Betweener. You can find out more about Todd and his work at toddfuller.com.au and on Instagram at fuller_Todd. Be sure to check out the show notes on this episode at inkandpaint.com.au for more information about the animation process. We'd love to hear your thoughts on Ink and Paint. Hit us up with your comments, questions, and even memories of your favourite Disney films, and we'll be sure to share them on our upcoming episodes. You can email Daniel at inkandpaint.com.au or find me on Twitter at Daniel Lamon. We'll be releasing new in-betweeners as we go along, so make sure you subscribe to Ink and Paint to make sure you don't miss any. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to rate and review and to tell your friends about us. Ink and Paint in-betweeners are created, hosted and written by myself, Daniel Lamon, and produced and edited by Alex Amster. Original music is composed by Sam Porter. The show artwork is designed by Nicholas Pirinakis, and the podcast is released through Switch. MakeTheSwitch.com.au. Join in next time on Ink and Paint to continue our journey through the Disney animated classics.